This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking to a panel of service providers, groups that focus on fighting poverty, helping people in need, and addressing mental health issues. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now are three guests on Skype. Allison Luthy is Executive Director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis. Ashley Overly is CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health. And Jamie Schnurple is Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Jamie, we'll start with you. Can you tell us about the Julian Center?
Certainly. So we are an organization that provides services for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. We have a continuum of services that include emergency shelter, community-based services, mental health services, legal service connection, as well as housing programs throughout Indianapolis.
And Jamie, I have so many questions about the trends in domestic violence since the pandemic started, but we'll get introductions out of the way. Sure. Ashley, what do you do primarily at the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center?
Hi there. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center. Sandra Eskenazi is a comprehensive community mental health center. So we see about 20,000 patients per year and provide a full spectrum of care for mental health services. So that ranges from acute care and crisis and inpatient services, outpatient services, residential services, housing supports, and a wide variety of subspecialty programs, including addiction. So we are located in nine different locations throughout Marion County and also provide services in 19 different schools.
And how have things changed for you, Ashley, since the pandemic started? How have services evolved?
They've evolved dramatically, I would say. Very quickly, within the span of about a week, from the time of learning about the first case of COVID in the state of Indiana, we began very quickly to start planning our response as a system, and then really very quickly transitioned almost everything that we could to telehealth services. That's really been the most dramatic change that we have made, is going from literally almost no telehealth services to almost exclusively telehealth services for outpatient visits that can be provided by telehealth.
And how does that affect the amount of patients that you can serve? Are there anyone for whom telehealth is a barrier to services that you provide?
Unfortunately, there are, yes. So I would say the telehealth experience is a very mixed experience. So on one hand, there are patients for whom providing telehealth alleviates a barrier. So patients for whom transportation is a barrier, these patients have been very happy and very receptive to receive telehealth services. Unfortunately, there are some patients that either do not have telephones or computers. They may not have wireless connections in their home, or they may have very limited minutes on their cell phones. And so for those patients, unfortunately, telehealth can be a barrier. And so to that end, we are still providing some services on site, and we also have a mobile team that we have created in order to be able to visit patients who aren't able to get into the clinics. But unfortunately, we do know that there still is a portion of people that have less access through telehealth than other traditional methods.
So limited visits, also the mobile team. But are there any tech accommodations that are being made for people for whom telehealth is really the best option, but they may not have the means to participate?
For those who do not have cell phones or internet in their homes, we are primarily trying to go out and visit them in the community. Again, those are sometimes it takes some some triaging and work on the part of the staff to really identify with a patient what specifically is the barrier. We are very grateful to Christian Theological Seminary for a generous gift of support that they have given us to help bridge some of the technology gaps that we have. This is primarily on the staff side of providing additional equipment for our staff to be able to provide telehealth services. So they have allowed us to buy additional equipment in order to capacitate our staff to provide increased telehealth services.
Allison, let's move on to you. What does the MLK Center do under normal circumstances?
Yeah, thanks. Under normal circumstances, we are a neighborhood-based community center in the mid-north part of Indianapolis. And so we primarily serve children at Indianapolis Public Schools number 43 and their families. So most of them live within a mile or a mile and a half of our center and utilize the park that's across the street. And so we have an after-school program, mental and emotional health services for them and their parents on site here. And parents can get employment coaching, financial coaching, and then we have a variety of community building activities and connecting people to their neighborhood association and to their neighbors. And then we have a teen employment program and then a Best Buy teen technology center that gives teens and young adults access to state-of-the-art technology and job skills and career pathways.
We are talking to a panel of service providers on poverty and helping people in need and also addressing mental health issues. And we're, of course, speaking on this topic through the lens of the pandemic today. And we are looking for your questions and comments to get into the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881 and leave a voicemail there along with your name and where you're calling from. Or you can get us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And we would love to get your question or comment in front of our panel today. So, Allison, how has the MLK Center expanded services amid the pandemic? I guess you're reaching outside the neighborhood by quite a bit.
We are. So about 2 days before IPS announced that they were going to close, we had an internal meeting to talk about what that could look like. So we at least had 2 days notice or 2 days preparation. And we knew that kids mostly get their meals at school. So we were able to pivot pretty quickly and started home delivery of meals, educational materials, laptop computers for e-learning, have connected a couple parents to additional data plans, and they had internet access, but it was only on their phone. So figuring out how to do that. And word quickly spread. So at the beginning, about half of the folks we were delivering to were in the neighborhood and half were outside the neighborhood. Additionally, we're partnering with the other 12 community centers in Indianapolis to divide up the entire city and figure out how to connect folks to rental and utility assistance. So while normally we would have a hyper-focus on kids at that school, we are now focusing on a broader part of the mid-north and north side of Indianapolis.
Would you say that the services that you are providing are services that you would otherwise provide to just your neighborhood network, and now you're simply expanding it, and you're doing it obviously a lot more, you're serving a lot more people now, but is that kind of the core of the MLK Center, kind of what you're doing now, what you're still doing, I suppose?
Yes. So normally we would still do, you know, connect folks to food, connect folks to financial resources. Now we're just spreading out a little further so that all the community centers can fill those gaps. We have spent around $60,000 on rent and utility assistance, which is more than we spent all of last year combined, and we spent that in about 6 weeks. So it's definitely a bigger scope, a bigger impact. There are people who are unemployed who've never needed assistance before, folks without childcare who've never needed assistance before. So being able to connect them to child cares that are still open, new resumes, new employment opportunities. We also have a transportation program that helps folks get to work. So thinking about those new connections for people.
Has it been overwhelming in any way to kind of see all of this unfold and see just how many people need the kinds of services that you provide?
Yeah, we're not very far from Broadapol that is, you know, Midtown has a lot of restaurants, so we have paid rent and utility assistance to a lot of folks that have worked in the restaurant industry, a lot of folks who work in the hotel and hospitality industry who did not need assistance before, but now they're just not even sure when their job is going to be available again. Even if, you know, restaurants start to open at half capacity, they're just not going to be able to fill all of those jobs. So while we normally have one employment coach, next week we will have three.
Wow. Okay. And so how busy are these people staying? I guess quite a bit.
Yes. So we have added on two contractual positions with emergency funding like that from CTS and other organizations so that we can help these new folks that are new to us. So we're not usually a very transactional organization. You don't just request your rent and get your rent paid. We build a relationship and do some other coaching. And so that takes time. But also, you know, we have a resident counselor on site who has also turned to remote services. And so connecting people to him to talk to about what's going on. Everyone's anxiety is high that maybe didn't experience that before. So just like mentioned from, you know, Eskenazi, we've got people who technology works for them now when they weren't able to come on site to see a counselor. You know, for some people, it's better that it's available through telehealth and online.
Ashley, I want to get back to this mobile team that you've formed for the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center. What does that look like when they go out? Are people working alone? Are they working with each other?
Well, we have a full team that we call it the MOVID team, actually, the mobile COVID team. And how this works is that all of our outpatient teams have the opportunity to refer into the mobile team. So people who are taking care of their patients as they would normally, attempting to do so now via telehealth, if they recognize a barrier for their patient to telehealth services, then they're able to make a referral to the mobile team and ask that that mobile team review the case and go out to the patient's house. And so that mobile team includes a nurse and an MA and a clinical therapist. And so they can deploy kind of as needed of who would be the best person, the best fit to meet whatever the need is. And so for the most part, it's actually been a lot of nursing services that has been needed. And so we've sent a lot of nursing visits out.
Ashley, we will continue after a quick break. And coming up, we will have more on poverty and mental health service providers amid the pandemic. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how service providers, groups that fight poverty, help people in need, and provide support to those with mental health issues, are getting by. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name, where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. We're joined again by Allison Luthi, Executive Director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis, Ashley Overlay, CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health, Jamie Schnurpel, Director of Services, Survivor Services at the Julian Center, and we're bringing in Lindsay Rabinowitch, Faith and Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary. Lindsay, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And can you tell us about the Faith and Action Project?
Sure. The Faith and Action Project at Christian Theological Seminary was launched in 2016 as a response to the poverty crisis in Indianapolis. And we really wanted to bring together faith communities and others to work together and collaborate and implement effective solutions for people confronting poverty. And we really wanted that collaboration to happen because there was so much siloed work happening, and we felt that we could increase the impact with the collaboration. And so through public events and our grants program, we seek to ignite just some hope and an interfaith movement for well-being and justice in our community.
And you've already gotten some shout-outs for the emergency relief grants that you've given to some of the groups that are represented today. How did those come about?
So Faith in Action has always been committed to the goal of long-term poverty mitigation. But we really wanted to address the crisis in front of us. And at Christian Theological Seminary, we believe that mental health is as important as food and shelter in overcoming the current challenges. And we know that many people in poverty, some of them already struggle with mental health issues. And the pandemic has increased those challenges by loss of employment, you know, other health risk, having their children not in school. And so we gathered together as a board and decided to create the emergency relief grants to get organizations much needed funding faster. And this process really allowed us to handpick groups that we knew were already doing poverty mitigation work, but that specifically included mental health services and family stability measures. So we delayed our annual grants program, which is focused on funding initiatives that work to break the cycle of poverty, and really focused on getting these organizations whose work included the mental health services funding very quickly. So it was a quick turnaround process, about 2 weeks.
So how did you then choose who gets them? I mean, you kind of gave us some general overview, but when you got right down into the nitty gritty and the work that the groups do, I guess what made those decisions clear?
Well, one thing about the Faith in Action Project at Christian Theological Seminary is that we have a lot of partners in the community, and we really reached out to those partners with a lot of conversation. We reached out to our grant recipients to understand what their current challenges were and how they were having to pivot to move away from their programming to really address the emergency needs, and also to see how their current situation, they weren't equipped for it. They didn't have all of the technology to really support those in need. And so as they were working on the front lines, they helped us identify the major needs. And then we worked to convene with our grants committee and our advisory board and say, here are the issues, and let's look at our pillars of addressing poverty, and health and mental health have always been one of those pillars of breaking the cycle of poverty. So we use the emergency relief grants to really double down on our efforts to push back poverty. And the seven organizations that were identified, we knew that they were already actively engaged in these mental health services and family stability measures, and had really been strategic about how they pivoted in response to the crisis. Because I think that's really important as we think about, you know, there were a lot of really great organizations that had responded to the pandemic, but which were the organizations that were strategic and responding, equipping and supporting individuals in poverty, and were really already planning for what it was going to look like 4 to 6 months down the road.
Jamie Schnurple, did the Julian Center receive one of these grants?
We did, and actually we are incredibly thankful to Christian Theological Seminary for selecting us. As Lindsay was saying, it was a true push in the direction of where we needed to get to very quickly in terms of equipping both our staff and our survivors with the capacity to participate in telehealth and teleadvocacy. So we are very grateful to CTS for the award.
And what did, what did you have to show that your organization was providing in order to be considered and obviously to eventually receive the grant itself?
Sure. So we are both a residential and a community-based or extended support program. And when you enter into the realm of residential, you tend to have different needs pretty quickly arise. So we had to show that normally we provide services in person on our campus for our shelter survivors in particular, but then also discuss our community-based survivors. So those folks who are in our housing programming, in other independent houses, apartments. We needed to discuss the lack of connection that we were seeing pretty quickly, having to eliminate the in-person meetings, even with our staff and our shelter survivors, opened up a level of anxiety for folks that are already displaced because of violence and trauma, and come up with a way to alleviate that and then bridge the gaps that existed. So we, you know, took a look at what our telehealth capacity would be and recognized that we needed additional bandwidth, additional resources, additional internet support. And then we, as a domestic violence survivor provider, have to meet another level of confidentiality protection. And so in addition to remaining compliant with HIPAA regulations that some of our counterparts would also need to maintain compliance with, and we do, we have additional expectation that we are following guidelines under the Violence Against Women's Act. So it added a little bit of a challenge for us, but thankfully through the CTS grant award, we were able to bridge that. We were able to provide additional laptops, additional bandwidth, additional cell phones for both clients and staff alike. And so far, we are continuing to see the numbers increase in requests and the services provided.
We're talking about how mental health service providers and groups that fight poverty and groups that help people in need are getting by in the pandemic today. And we are joined by Allison Luthi, Executive Director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis, Ashley Overly, CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health, and Jamie Schnurple, who you just heard, Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center. We're also joined by Lindsay Rabinowitch, Faith and Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary. And if you have questions or comments on today's discussion, you can share them with us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881, and we will get them into our live conversation today. So, Jamie, we've been hearing a lot about how domestic violence has increased amid the pandemic. What does the shelter look like right now? I mean, are you still taking people into the shelter? And what are the protocols to keep people safe from the virus itself?
Absolutely. So initially, we did take some time to stop receiving intakes for a couple of weeks so that we could really take a hard look at our room configuration and what our cleaning standards needed to, you know, what standards we needed to hit in order to maintain full sanitation of the space, more so than we normally had. So for a couple of weeks, we had to stop bringing people in and kind of reduce our numbers. But now we are bringing people in for intakes. So our shelter isn't quite full, but it's starting to pick up. We have increased our cleaning and sanitation spaces, but we've also, using the guidelines set forth by the governor and the CDC, Department of Health, we are maintaining commitment to social distancing, and that includes in all of our programs, includes our playgrounds, it includes inside and out. And by doing that, it's caused us to look at how we provide our meals, how we provide e-learning opportunities for all of our kids. We have 32 kids right now who are in shelter and receiving services from us. So we've had to adapt quite a bit. Additionally, we do have screening processes. One of the things that I've explained to people is when you're working with a residential facility, you have to be concerned not just about an individual family, but 100 people who are around each other all of the time. So we have essentially a family of 100 people. And to that end, we have had to increase our screening for potential exposure when people are going back to work or have gone to the grocery store, who have gone to doctor's appointments that weren't able to attend to virtually. So that includes ensuring people don't have a fever, ensuring that they themselves have not had a person around them that has tested positive or that they haven't tested positive. So we do go through a full screening process every single time somebody comes into shelter, whether they're coming in for the first time or for the 10th time, we ensure that we go through that screening process. Through a partnership with the City of Indianapolis and Department of Health, we do have a referral source. So we are able to, if we have someone who needs it, to refer out for treatment for COVID. Additionally, we've taken a couple of our rooms offline in the event that we have folks who need to stay here on site in shelter, but also have needs to isolate or to quarantine themselves. So it's caused us to change a little bit of our service delivery, but the services themselves have continued. On average, in a normal year, we provide services for approximately 6,000 people. Generally speaking, about 500 of those are going to be in our shelter. One of the things that I've been keeping an eye on is tracking the number of people we're serving in shelter during this particular time compared to previous years. And our numbers are very similar. The difference that we're seeing is the lethality or the risk of potential death that a person is facing in the relationship that they're fleeing. That's where we've seen a growing trend of danger and potential for lethality.
Why is that?
Well, particularly folks who are out in the community, when we went into social isolation mode, several things happened. The first is you're now essentially forced or required to shelter in place with the person who is causing you harm, whether physical, emotional, sexual. So when places closed and when social distancing was put in place, we are now seeing that survivors or victims in that moment are having to stay at home with their abuser. Couple that, which is in itself an inherently dangerous place to be, you don't have the breaks that you normally do, where abuser is going to work, or you're going to work, or your children are going to school to reach out for services. And then you add in the potential of lost income and the stress that that brings, and the fact that we don't know how long this will be. And then if we have children, you now have to educate while also trying to keep yourself safe in essentially one of the most dangerous places for you. So it's a little bit of, it's a bunch of different ingredients that lend itself to high level of violence. Stress and anxiety, loss of income are huge triggers. And so unfortunately we're doing the best that we can, and we're reaching out to people, and we've come up with creative ways to connect, but that's why we're seeing it. We're seeing people who don't have a way to leave that normally they would. And it's just a matter of, you know, kind of figuring it out and navigating that with them. And when and if we can get people to safety, we do. While we had to close our shelter for a couple of weeks to kind of get things where we needed to be, we've also partnered with hotels. And so even in that time, we were working to get people safe. So it's kind of changed the way we're looking at things, and changing the types of services that we're providing in the sense that it's not in person, it's telehealth and through email and through any way we can connect with people.
Lindsay, was it the emergence of what looks like a trend in an uptick in domestic violence that that led you, in addition, I'm sure, to the application, to the grant to the Julian Center through the Faith in Action Project?
Yes, I think that as she mentioned, that this population is already at risk, already needed the mental health support. But then with the circumstances that they're in, this population needed more support than ever. Just as she described, that, you know, they're together in a situation that is not ideal for anyone. And this situation is exacerbated by being together with the abuser. And, you know, this population, of those in poverty, those that are facing these risks of abuse, it's a scary time no matter what. And then you add the pandemic on top. We really felt it was an urgent need to provide funding and additional resources.
Coming up, we will keep the conversation going with poverty and mental health service providers, talking about how they've adapted in the last couple of months and their plans for the future. We are live with Ashley Overly, CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health, Jamie Schnurple, Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center, and Lindsay Rabinowitch, Faith and Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary. And we are also joined, of course, by Allison Luthi, Executive Director of of the MLK Center in Indianapolis, and we would like to hear your thoughts. Please find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. We would love your input on today's live conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. We are back in 2 minutes. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion with a panel of service providers, groups that focus on fighting poverty, helping people in need, and addressing mental health issues. We're joined again by Allison Luthy, Executive Director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis, Ashley Overly, CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health, Jamie Schnurple, Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center, and Lindsay Rabinowitch, Faith and Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary, which issued grants to the other groups that are present today in order to help them continue to provide their services through the pandemic. And we would love your questions and comments on today's show. We are live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. Allison, I want to get back to you. Has it been a challenge, Allison, to simply get information out about what you're doing during all of this? I mean, it seems like you have broadened not only your services, but also the footprint under which you operate. Do enough people know that these services are still available?
I think that's a constant challenge. We're always trying to let folks know that we're here. We have spent a lot of time reaching out to people, calling all of our kids, calling families. In normal times, you usually can go to a food pantry once a month. So we've had to call people and let them know that we would deliver to them 3 times a week and that that was okay. They could call as often as they needed it. We were delivering fresh meals prepared by the Patitude Foundation and Second Helpings. So we didn't want to just bring you food once a week. We brought it 3 times a week. We're winding that down because folks, the food pantry in our neighborhood is open now, and there are other folks doing home delivery. Gleaners had a large giveaway at the fairgrounds this weekend, and the line was around the fairgrounds, which I know some of those folks don't know that we've been delivering 3 days a week. So constant communication of what's available is always important. We always find that word of mouth is the best way to get the word out. Folks will call and say, you helped my cousin with her rent, or you helped my sister with her utility bill. You know, what do I need to do, or who do I call? So we've spent a lot of time calling people as well. Some people think we're closed and we're not open at all. So letting them know that we do have remote services, you can come to the back door and we'll talk to you, social distancing, and have phone conversations. And not every landlord has an online portal to pay their rent. So we do have to print checks and get those to folks. So it's definitely constant communication.
Well, I'd imagine that the MLK Center relies heavily on volunteers. And a lot of what we've heard through the pandemic is that a lot of people who are volunteers are also in a group that is at risk, older people and people with other conditions. Have you had a hard time getting volunteers to get all this work done?
Yes and no. So that's part of the reason that our local food pantry had to close, was because most of their volunteers were older or in a risk population. For us, we did close down any volunteers being able to come into the building. So we were able to reassign some of our after-school staff to help with food delivery so that we didn't have to lay anybody off. And they packaged the meals every day. And then we had a safe distancing protocol where they would take them out and put them in people's cars, and those volunteers could deliver them. And then they could leave the food on the front porch or the door or right outside the apartment door and call families and tell them that their food was outside. So there were some volunteers that were able to do that that weren't able to do some other things. We normally year-round use volunteers to tutor in our after-school program and read to kids and do literacy. And so that, I would say, has been a challenge to get folks connected online to their tutor and to the kids. Most of our families have multiple kids, and so being in front of the computer together or sharing a computer for online learning and getting connected to your tutor has been a challenge. But we were overwhelmed with volunteers willing to deliver food to home. That's the only way we were able to deliver, on some days, 120 addresses a day. And folks were willing to go all over the county to get the food to those who needed it. So for that, the way we set up social distancing and cleaning protocols worked out.
There's a lot of talk of heroes these days, and there are a lot of different heroes, and they all look different. Who are these volunteers? How have so many people been able to step up when so many people are being told to stay at home? Are these new faces, or are these reserves that you've called upon?
For most of ours, they were new. And so they were folks, a couple of people would come on their lunch hour, so they were working from home. They've been, you know, their business is now working remote, so they've been able to come. We delivered every day at 11:30. And if you only have two or three or four addresses, you could easily get that done in an hour. By not having to make contact with us and not having to make physical contact with the family, it was easy. We did ask them to be healthy. Some people wanted to bring their children, and so we told them that was up to them. But being able to just make a circle through our parking lot and come to a table and pick up a box of food that had the name and the address and the phone number made it really simple for anybody who could lift a box that weighed about less than 20 pounds. It made it really easy for anybody to be able to do that service. And I think for some folks who got a stimulus check and didn't financially need it, they were able to make donations. Others who were still employed and collecting a paycheck, but able to get out and be of service. We had more volunteers than we needed.
Well, other than the stimulus checks that have been signed over your way, and good on the people who are able to do that, what kind of other financial support, other than the grants from Christian Theological Seminary, which is kind of the reason we're all talking today through the Faith in Action Project, what other help have you gotten in order to do this kind of work and ramp things up the way you have?
Yeah, we have seen an increase both in dollar amounts and the number of individuals donating, because I think we sit next door to million-dollar condos, and four blocks away there are abandoned houses. And so we stand in that gap every day, and something like a pandemic highlights those inequities and challenges that people are facing every day with access to all sorts of things. And so we've been able to use a lot of those donations to do that rent and utility assistance that is about four times what we normally see. I think I mentioned we spent in 6 weeks what we normally would spend in more than half a year. So we've been able to reserve that fund, because I think being able to stay in your home and not face eviction and not have your utilities on and being able to feed your family or something that everybody cares about, no matter how much money you make. So we've been able to shift that a little bit and create this fund that both grant funds, but individuals too can contribute. And then we have, you know, protocols set up and a pretty simple system where folks can apply online to get emergency financial assistance or call our front desk, and we move the money pretty quickly.
We're talking with Allison Luthi. She's executive director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis, and we're on live with a panel of people from service providers around town addressing mental health issues, also domestic violence. We're on with Ashley Overly, CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health, Jamie Schnurple, director of survivor services at the Julian Center, and Lindsay Rabinowitch, Faith in Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary, which issued grants to all of the groups today representing. Ashley, so what would you say the people you serve need most right now amid this pandemic in terms of mental health services?
You know, a lot of the needs that we see facing our clients are really the chronic needs that we always see, and we're just having to meet them in a new and different way right now. We actually did a survey of our staff recently to assess their experience of their patients' needs to try and understand, are the needs changing right now? Are they the same? You know, what are really going to be the most important things for us to try and address as an organization? And the top needs that people identified, other than their ongoing mental health needs, were really the psychosocial determinants of health that we know are always important. So food actually was the number one thing that people mentioned as a top need of their patients right now. So food, housing, income, all of those things that we know are always important for our population. And some of those needs have just been exacerbated due to the pandemic right now.
Well, and the state has put out a roadmap to reopen the economy, and the details are subject to change, of course. But right now, the slow rollback on the stay-at-home order ends on July 4th. Do you or Eskenazi Health have a timeline right now on a long-term plan? I would imagine Eskenazi Health that things are a little bit different considering you're a health provider.
Right, yeah. So throughout the pandemic, we have continued to offer a small number of on-site services because we know that there are certain things that we can only do face-to-face. Injections is a great example of that. And so right now, what we are doing is planning to open up very gradually. So kind of aligned with the different phases that the governor has laid out, we are planning on just very incrementally adding staff back. However, we believe that many people will continue to offer telehealth services for the many months to come right now. But we're reviewing our physical sites right now, making sure that they allow for appropriate social distancing, making sure that we have enough PPE as we add staff back so that everyone is wearing the appropriate PPE, and then just getting the word out to patients of where they can expect or have the opportunity to receive services.
Ashley, this might be kind of a hard question to answer because when the pandemic happened, it seemed like everyone who had to keep working got busier because not only were they doing their work, but they were also trying to figure out how to do their work in a different space or how to adapt their work to the circumstances of the pandemic. But we keep hearing about how the pandemic has exacerbated mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that? Are you and your staff, in a way, a lot busier now because of it?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, all of the things that we know contribute to worsened mental health, for example, joblessness, isolation, these are things that we know through robust amounts of evidence that these are conditions that worsen people's mental health. And so we know that these are more present in our community now. And so we anticipate an increase in need for our services. Overall, the number of visits that we're providing is about what we expect to do, you know, for the what we had budgeted to be doing prior to the pandemic. And so we've hypothesized about this a little bit. On one hand, we're wondering if people are frightened to come to the hospital was mentioned earlier, some people don't know. It's a challenge to get the communication out that we're still open for services. People can access us through telehealth. And so we're trying to overcome some of those communication barriers to just let people know, like we want them to come and seek treatment for their mental health needs now more than ever. And so we're thinking that as things start to open up and people get out and about more, that we might see that increase spike maybe later. But you are correct. Absolutely. We've been working very hard in addition to meeting the mental health needs of our patients, trying also to respond to the mental health needs of our workforce. And so we've been working with the Indiana Division of Mental Health and Addiction to provide, for example, psychological first aid to the Department of Corrections staff and to our Eskenazi Health staff. And really doing some additional outreach to provide support for a lot of those first responders and essential workers that we know have been under enormous amounts of stress since the beginning of this pandemic.
Jamie Schnirpel, you are the Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center, and I'm curious, is there any risk that your group could run out of money if you keep operating in these circumstances for a certain amount of time?
I mean... You can never really have an official answer to that, right?
Yeah, that's always a worry in the back of the mind of a lot of nonprofits, right?
And I was just going to say, I think we, along with everyone else, rely very heavily on different funding sources, including grants such as the grant from CTS and our other grantors and different funding streams, both foundation and government, and also personal donations. And so I think that, you know, as time goes, we'll continue to reevaluate and take a look. But at this point, no, I don't think we're going to run out of money, and we'll continue to operate. I think one of the one of the realities of the work that we do, unfortunately, is that domestic violence and sexual assault is ever present. And, you know, the fact that it doesn't, you know, it's much like mental health, it doesn't discriminate, right? So you're going to find it anywhere, means that we end up being a very necessary service. And so, you know, we're here, we're open for business and continuing. I appreciate that Ashley brought up providing first aid for our frontline and our essential employees and staff out there. I know my staff is running ragged trying to do everything that they can do. And that's really, we rely heavily on them to help us continue to keep things going and continue to keep morale up. And so recognizing that too, but fundamentally, I think we are okay. as okay as any other, you know, nonprofit can be okay.
Allison Luthia, I'd like to pose the same question to you, since your organization, the MLK Center, has really ramped up services and provided services to more people outside of the neighborhood. Are you worried about that? Is that something you're worried about, running out of money?
Yeah. You know, one of the biggest grants we have is an after school grant. And so thinking about what the school is going to look like in the fall, how much of our staff time is reimbursable through that grant. They pay us after we pay our folks and submit timesheets. So paying the staff, I'm not as much worried about it, but we will have to stop paying rent and utilities when that pot of money runs out. And so we're working all the time, you know, to write grant proposals, have community outreach opportunities like this, working with the city of Indianapolis to see what federal money will be coming through. There is, you know, emergency FEMA money and eviction prevention money available. Just need to figure out how to get that and work with the city on the best system. But that's, you know, there isn't an unlimited pot of money. And some folks, again, are going to go back to work quicker than others. And, you know, even if they do go back to work, does it pay at the same salary for the same family budget that they had before? And so that just takes kind of moving around of some money for us to be able to help people over a long period of time. Usually, you know, the program doesn't like to pay folks rent for more than 2 months at a time. So what happens when someone is unemployed for 6 months? So I think for rent and utility assistance, it'll be a judgment call, and continuing to work with other providers around the city to make sure that folks don't lose their home.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests today. Allison Luthia is Executive Director of the MLK Center in Indianapolis. Allison, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Overly is the CEO of the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center at Eskenazi Health. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you.
Jamie Schnurple is Director of Survivor Services at the Julian Center. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, Matt.
And Lindsay Rabinowitz is the Faith in Action Project Director at Christian Theological Seminary. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us and highlighting this important topic.
And thanks for listening. This is All In.